This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
This is a crowd podcast.
We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Hemingway,
Eichmann,
Stranger in a Strange Land,
Dylan,
Berlin,
Bay of Pigs Invasion,
Lawrence of Arabia,
British Beatlemania,
Ole Miss,
John Glenn,
Liston beats Patterson,
Pope Paul,
Malcolm X,
British politician sex.
Oh, I say.
Really? Hello and welcome to episode 95 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the podcast that explores post-war history and all the reasons why the world is like it is today, all done through the lyrics of a number one smash hit from the legend that is Billy Joel. I am Tom Fordyce.
I'm Katie Puckrick.
Katie, are we ready for the next scurrilous part of our beautiful adventure?
Well, I think it's a beautiful part of our scurrilous adventure, but I suppose it depends on which side of the loin you lie. Today's topic is British politician sex. It refers to John Profumo, who was the Secretary of State for War in Harold Macmillan's conservative government in 1961. He had an extramarital affair with 19-year-old showgirl Christine Keeler, and the roister-doistering had a potential crossover with a Russian spy, which elevated it, Tom, from generic jiggery-pokery to international spy shagathon, which is why we're still talking about it today. Did you have an awareness? You must have had an awareness as a young British boy growing up in the decade or so after it happened.
So, Katie, my first dealings with it came through the film Scandal, which came out in, I think, 1988 or 1989. This was the story of the Profumo affair, dramatised, of course, with Joanne Wally-Kilmer as Christine Keeler, with Bridget Fonda as Mandy Rice Davis. It had John Hurt in a superb turn as Stephen Ward, who we will hear more about. But the line that I've never forgotten comes from Ian McKellen, who plays the titular John Profumo. And at some point in the film, he turns to Christine Keeler and says, "You've never truly made love until you've made love in a gondola."
Well, I'll certainly put that on my making love to-do list. The only thing that I was really aware of before that film was the famous photograph of Christine Keeler taken by Lewis Morley. She's sitting naked the wrong way around on a knockoff of an Arne Jacobson chair, which apparently was sold by Heels or Habitat or something. And my concern is with the varnish on that chair. I mean, is it very sensible to sit with a warm, moist body? What's that going to do, the lacquer? I don't know. We do have an expert in who can tell us about lacquer and other things. She is sex historian, author of The Curious History of Sex, and host of the podcast Betwixt the Sheets, The History of Sex, Scandal, and Society, a podcast from History Hit. Also, I do love her Twitter account, Whores of Yore. Lots of deep dives and Victorian muffs. Please welcome Kate Lister.
Hello.
Hello, Kate. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of this topic, I'm wondering if you can just sketch out briefly, what was Britain like in 1961? Just kind of socially and politically, post-war doldrums, I would imagine.
That is a question. Do you know what? I'm actually going to start with the sitting on the chair the wrong way around before I forget about it, because she was actually wearing knickers She was really like adamant in later years that people knew she wasn't entirely naked. She had knickers on. I don't know what difference that makes, but I feel just on her behalf, I should continue this defence. You couldn't actually see her boobs either because she sat backwards on the chair. But then all of this affair is about the nuance of, you know, the fine lines, walking the line between I'm a showgirl, I'm a hooker, I'm a good time girl, I'm a mistress, I'm this, I'm that. And it's all very murky and muddy. And a lot of this comes down to how are you going to define things?
Exactly. It's like, is she a predator or is she a victim? That's what makes it so tantalizing. And of course, that is pretty much what happens to women through the years who are often cast aside. They're often, you know, the triggers for the downfall of established men, and then they get all of the blame shoved onto them.
Right, absolutely. What was Britain like in 1960? It's only 15 years after the end of the Second World War at that point. It's tempting for us when we think of the 60s, we think of like the Beatles and the Who and the Rolling Stones and all that, and think that it's a completely different era from World War II, ration books, trenches, the Blitz. But it's only 15 years. Like, that's their equivalent of, fast maths, 2007, right? So it's like, it's really got a huge impact on where they are at that point. The economy is just starting to get its shit back together, basically. And Harold Macmillan, who is the prime minister during this affair, at the beginning of his tenure, he was famous for saying that the British public had never had it so good. So sort of at the beginning, there's this kind of wave of optimism that he brings in. And as the decade progressed, they did have to bring in more and more economic measures that became stricter and stricter. So it started really strong and really optimistic, and then people start feeling the pinch. But yeah, you have to remember all the way through this that the Second World War and all that paranoia and fear around spies and international espionage, that's only 15 years behind them.
And when we look at Christine Keeler's background, Kate, it seems to reflect all those post-war nuances. So she grows up in a house which is made of converted railway carriages, which doesn't sound particularly salubrious. She's abandoned by her father. She gets a job in a dress shop in Soho at 15. And Soho at that time is it a murky place? Yeah, maybe it's a murky place, but it's a fascinating place. And it's the place where lots of different worlds and lots of different lives, lots of different social backgrounds all intersect.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it certainly is murky, and it has that reputation as being quite murky. But Christine Keeler's background is one of poverty, and it is one of abuse. She was later claimed that she was abused by her stepfather. And, you know, I mean, like, what has to happen in your home life for you to end up on your own in Soho at the age of 15, for God's sake? I mean, could you like imagine that, like, you know, at 15, that you're suddenly in London trying to make your way in the world? So she doesn't have a strong supportive system around her. She did grow up in poverty, like you said, these kind of converted railway carriages, which just doesn't sound good at all. She's obviously left school quite early, and she finds herself in London attempting to make a living as a 15-year-old, which, I mean, I think I still did a paper round when I was 15, for God's sake. So yeah, she's trying to make a living, and eventually she gets a job as a showgirl at a club called Murray's in Soho, where there was nude dancing, topless dancing, nude waitress, etc. And the waiters and the girls would then meet clients, and assignations would happen.
And one of the men she meets there is Stephen Ward. And this is sort of the beginning of the thread that will lead into the greater picture, isn't it? Stephen Ward is an osteopath, but he's also an artist. And the more I read about him, Kate, the more fascinating he seems.
He's this really kind of unlikely linchpin in the whole story, because when you go, he's an osteopath, you're like, doesn't he just does backs? But he had super elite clients. Like, a lot of his clients were MPs, a lot of his clients were in the aristocracy, actors. So he's also somebody that meets people, very influential people. He's got a lot of contacts, and that allows him access to different worlds. And he is an artist, and he's quite bohemian, and he is definitely the vanguard of sort of the 1960s zeitgeist of sexual freedom. But yeah, he is a really interesting character in all of this.
And were they sexually involved or romantically involved?
Apparently not. They both swore it down until they never ever admitted anything that happened. I mean, he was in his 40s when they met, and she was maybe barely 19. They always described it as being like brother and sister, so there's something platonic about it.
And I guess from her perspective, Kate, she would have been thinking, yeah, I'm just scraping by here. Mm. It'd be really nice to live in a lovely Muse flat with this well-appointed older gentleman. But what was he getting out of the friendship?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. That is the... And it wasn't just Christine Keeler. There was also another young girl of the same age, Mandy Rice Davis, and there was a few others that all sort of seemed to congregate at his establishment, at his home. They all lived there for certain periods of time. He did have sex with Mandy Rice Davis, at least that's what it was claimed. But it's sort of like, what did he get out of that? What did this man in his 40s get out of hanging around with 18-year-old showgirls in his apartment? Because what he was later accused of was pimping them out, certainly. Christine Keeler and Mandy Rice Davis spoke very highly of Stephen all the way through their lives. But looking back on it and sort of all the pieces, I think he knew the power of introducing very wealthy, influential men to very young, beautiful girls.
There's a point where he feels like, and you're right, he is that powerful person who moves between different worlds. His clinic is in Cavendish Square, which is a very la-di-da part of London. He starts doing portrait sketches for the la-di-das of London. And then he also befriends a man called Yevgeny Ivanov, who is a Soviet intelligence officer at the Soviet embassy. And this is the next thread that we need to pull.
Yeah. So he's friends with a lot of people. He is. And he's also friends with Viscount Astor, Viscount William Astor, like serious big aristocracy names. And he meets Ivanov at Astor's country pile, Cliveden. Mm. Ivanov is introduced himself as like a Russian attaché to the Russian embassy, but he was an agent. And yeah, Stephen definitely knew the value of that. But precisely what went on, who was spying for who knew what, were they just mates, were they not just mates? That, it's still very murky and we still don't know the full truth to that.
And let's get to the title character, John Profumo. What was his deal? Who was he?
He was, I mean, he came from a lot of money. His family was very, very wealthy. He had all the privileges of a super wealthy upbringing. And he was the Secretary of State for War, married to an actress, Valerie Hobson. Very, very powerful, very well connected, as MPs still are today.
And so was John Profumo known for playing around, or was this out of character for him when he took up with Christine Keeler?
Do you know what? He probably, I mean, I don't think any of the MPs at that particular time would have wanted you to dig too far into their personal lives. The scandal of an MP having an extramarital affair with a young girl wouldn't have raised many eyebrows. I think that probably a lot of them were at it. But what made this one different was the Russian agent connection, because Christine Keeler and Ivanov became lovers at the same time she became lovers with Profumo.
Okay, so let's back up for a minute. How did Christine end up at that summer party at Cliveden when she met John Profumo?
Stephen Ward brought her there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, again, see, that's kind of, it's like murky, isn't it? That, you know, just like why, I don't know, like I'm a university lecturer. I spend a lot of time around 18 and 19-year-olds and they're great to teach. I love that. But as a 41-year-old woman, like they're not my friends. Like, I don't want to hang out with them outside of that. I mean, and I know in our head we all think that we're still 21, but when you speak to a 21-year-old, you're like, yeah, I'm definitely not. So why was he hanging around with these 18-year-olds and bringing them to Viscount Astor's house and all of these? But anyway, that is where Christine Keeler meets Profumo. He's there with his wife. And the story goes that the first time he saw her, she was swimming naked. And apparently he was smitten with her.
That'll do it.
Katie, I was going to try and paint a picture of what Cliveden looks like and what the swimming pool looks like. Since you've actually been there, I'm going to pass that task to you.
Well, Cliveden is a very grand pile. It's set in the countryside. Actually, Tom, I don't know what part of the British countryside. I just know there's London, there's Manchester, and then there's the countryside. So maybe you can fill in the geographical blanks.
Yeah, Katie, it is to the west of London. It is not far from the Thames when the Thames is a mere trickle compared to what it will be. In modern terms, the nearest place is probably Maidenhead. There's also Slough. Cliveden is the sort of place that wouldn't want to be associated with Slough, I imagine.
Okay. Well, I can tell you, I was actually there some decades ago. I was actually doing a travel show, an episode of a luxury travel show. And I do remember the man in charge was fluttering around very anxiously because he did not want us to allude to the Profumo scandal. And he burst into one of the beautifully appointed bedrooms. And there I was sitting in the bed wearing a 1960s slut slip, a very Liz Taylor Butterfield 8 number, propped up by oodles of pillows. And he just threw himself across in front of the camera and just said, no, 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 stop filming. And it really was above board. We were just talking about all the ins and outs of the history of this place. But I can tell you, it's a very beautiful, lush, plush, stately pile. And it's like something out of a fairy tale.
Okay. And it sounds, Kate, like we think about the 60s as a point where different parts of society in Britain all came together. Mm. And you would have barrow boys, photographers meeting with aristocrats and penniless pop stars from the north mixing with people who they'd never met before in the south, and gangsters and all that sort of stuff. This particular day, it feels almost like the start of that whole process.
Yeah. I mean, the 60s definitely saw a softening of attitudes around class. But I think that because today we like to think that, you know, we don't do class anymore in Britain. Yes, we do. Yeah, we do. Like, how many mansions do you go and hang out at the weekend? And we've still got aristocracy. Not enough. And we've still got aristocracy, and we've still got lords and ladies and people with vast amounts of money. So it's still in force. And in the 60s, it certainly was. And this is 1961. So this is right at the beginning of the 60s. So all of this stuff is even more ingrained. It's even more impressive that, you know, a girl from a railway carriage outside of London is meeting Viscount Astor at his enormous country pile.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. I've got a question for you. How is your social battery feeling right now? Because it can be easy to ignore how we're feeling and sometimes spread ourselves too thin. You know what it's like. Social gatherings are starting to pick up pace after the long drag of winter. But what's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Well, therapy can help give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So if you're thinking of exploring these areas and starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/WDSTF for We Didn't Start the Fire. That's betterhelp.com/WDSTF. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Always fresh and never frozen. Each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat flexitarian, so with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. So last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon. It was absolutely delicious. These are no-fuss, no-mess meals. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savour the good stuff. With over 60 add-ons like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies, there's plenty of options to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Plus, you can customise your weekly meals and pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/WDSTF50 and use the code WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WDSTF50 at factormeals.com/WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'm wondering how often Christine and John saw each other. Like, what did they get up to? Where did they meet? How long did the whole thing last?
He never actually admitted that they'd had sex, even when it was like, it was beyond doubt at this point. I think he was still publicly clinging to it. But their affair, probably it was a few weeks or a few months. So it's very flash in the pan stuff. It seems that the first time that they had sex was maybe at the Cliveden, possibly at Stephen Ward's apartment. But it was certainly no great dramatic love affair.
There's a great quote, Katie, from both parties in this. Christine Keeler has apparently described the affair as, quote, a screw of convenience. And here's a line from John Profumo. He says, she was completely uneducated. She had no conversation beyond hair, makeup and records. Some of the best conversations I've ever had have been about hair, makeup and records.
Yeah, so it's no great romance, is it? This is a man that wants to have sex and he's not interested in anything else.
Yeah, he's getting his rocks off. And so was there crossover then? I guess that was the big problem. There was crossover during the time that Christine was with John Profumo and then also with Evgeny Ivanov, the Russian agent.
Yeah, that is the linchpin in all of this. So she was the lover of both of them. Whether or not that was just like a coincidence, how much she as a 19-year-old was actually even really aware of this stuff is very much up for debate. But it has been suggested that Stephen Ward had been approached by MI5 to try and get information out of Ivanov. And in later police reports, Christine said that Ivanov had been asking to try and get information about various tactics from Profumo. But it's all... We just don't know. What we do know is that pretty much that she was the lover of both of them at the same time. And a lot has been made of that.
You know, Kate, it strikes me now, having heard the quote that Tom relayed about, oh, all Christine wanted to talk about was makeup and pop music. Of course, he would say that because that's a way of saying, oh, we never talked about state secrets and stuff. So that's him throwing the heat off. So I guess, you know, if you took his word for it, he's in the clear because she's not passing anything along that's of a sensitive nature.
Yes.
When did MI5 get a load of the friskiness? Were they tipped off right off the bat? And I wonder who did tip them off.
So they had been aware of Ivanov for a while. They'd been aware of Stephen Ward for a while. I mean, he's useful, right? If you like MI5, he's got contacts all over the place. He's kind of, and he has a reason to, because he's osteopath or whatever he was. So they'd been aware of him. But apparently John Profumo was tipped off by someone at MI5 when they realized basically it's traceable, you know, like you're having sex with this girl who's having sex with this man. And he was kind of warned off. And it's been suggested that was kind of why the affair very suddenly was ended.
It seems to be, Kate, that as much as the original scandal, it's the attempts to cover up the scandal that eventually leads to the downfall of everyone involved.
Always is. I mean, what's that? Is it the Barbara Streisand rule? Is that if you try and cover something up, then people just get more and more interested in it. Like, she tried to stop some pictures of a house or something being in the press. Then everyone was fascinated. Like, what are these pictures? Then everyone wanted to see, whereas no one would give them stuff before. Yeah, the fact that they tried to cover it up made it infinitely more tantalizing and more mysterious and more interesting later down the line.
Yeah, even though perhaps there wasn't any there. What was the Prime Minister's response? What did Harold Macmillan have to say about it?
There's a line in his diary, where, like very early on, where he's been made aware of this, like before the shit has really hit the fan. And he sort of says something along the lines of like, oh, we had to deal with, you had to spend a day dealing with nonsense today. I'm paraphrasing, but it was just, he's just more angry that he had to deal with just such silliness, like the silliness of MPs.
That's so funny. And also, I actually read that he went on to say something like, you know, what's the big deal? It's only sex with a woman. Like, not the bigger crime of sex with boys, which is the typical thing that you hear about. Like, who cares?
Yeah. I think that was his attitude early on. And of course, like, then this is all caught up with the idea of like people are entitled to a private life and is it really that interesting and blah, 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 and all of that stuff. But in the beginning of this, I think he was more irritated that he had to pay any attention to it at all.
There is quite a long gap, isn't there, Kate, looking at this between when the affair begins and when the scandal unravels. So it's July in 1961 that the scandal begins. And we go all the way through to January 1963 before Ivanov is recalled by the Soviets to Moscow. That's when Christine Keeler first tries to sell her story to the papers. Profumo makes his statement denying an affair to the House of Commons in March, doesn't actually resign until June. It's such a slow process as everyone works through the ramifications and what it means and what might transpire at the end.
I suppose it's one of those, it was an open secret, like the press knew, but nobody's going to print that story because John Primo has got very deep pockets. Very, so no one's going to print it unless you're absolutely sure. But what kicks it off is a few years later, Christine Keeler is in, she's in a string of awful relationships with like various jazz musicians around Notting Hill. And one of them fires a gun at her and the police have to get involved. And I think it's during the statement that she mentions Profumo. So now his name's out there. Like, oh, shit. You know, so she's the one that sort of starts talking, and then there's interest, and then there's political intrigue, because obviously Profumo's got enemies, the Tories have got enemies, and this is a really juicy bit of information that anybody, you know, wants to do some serious damage to the reputation of the Tory parties. So it's Christine who kind of first blows the cover, but then it gets picked up by the press, and then she starts wanting to sell her story.
It sounds a little bit, Kate, like it's weaponized cynicism, because really, amidst the ruling class and the patriarchy, nobody really cares that he had a little bit of friskiness on the side. They only care when it seems like it's a little bit of leverage that the enemies can use. But it's not like people are that frightened of morality and double standards and that kind of thing. And they're certainly not concerned about Christine Keeler, are they?
I mean, it's double standards. You kind of hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I think this is still true to a certain extent. There's a lot of stuff that a lot of people get up to in private, and it's private, and it only hits the proverbial fan when it becomes public. Boris Johnson, for example, has had, by all accounts, several extramarital affairs, and he's not even sure about how many kids he has. And, you know, what else don't we know that he's... And he clearly doesn't seem bothered by that, but sort of scandal is made out of it. And I think it's, yeah, it is the double standards, and it's the people on the opposite bench trying to attack and wound their political opponents. And they're using Christine Keeler to do this.
There's a lot of punching down going on, isn't there, Kate? When there is the parliamentary debate on the 17th of June in 1963, it's Christine Keeler and it's Stephen Ward who are vilified by people from a background of great privilege.
Honestly, that the whole thing makes me so mad. And I think that the entire case is due for proper review. And, you know, the post-Me Too era of just like, well, what in the hell was going on here? You know, Christine Keeler was barely 19 when this happened. Barely 19, from a really impoverished background. She was the least powerful person in this situation. And she was the one that was scapegoated and criticised and made out to be this like horribly manipulative, nasty person. And Stephen Ward, who I don't think is entirely innocent in this, but he was scapegoated for this as well, because the establishment just closed ranks around it. Like they needed somebody to blame, and he was blamed. Charges were brought against him for living off immoral earnings, and it was never proven. It was all trumped up. It was complete nonsense. Did no one stop at any point and think, it's a teenager, for God's sake?
No, you wouldn't bother doing that. And especially since the idea is, in those days, and to an extent this continues, if she has already put herself in that milieu of being somebody who disports herself in the nutty, then she gets what's coming to her. What was the response in the media and with the public?
I mean, it was one of those ones, it was like a slow burner, but once it blew, it blew. So it could only be properly reported in the media without fear of being sued. When it was an MP, it was George Wigg, who used his parliamentary privilege to basically name John Profumo in this kind of growing scandal, these rumours that an MP had been involved in possible Russian espionage, and he named him. And from that point on, anyone could print anything. But they're still going to be very careful about John Profumo because he's the one with the power. So Christine Keeler just gets dragged through all this, and she's 19, for God's sake. So like, people are offering her money for the story, and they want as many juicy details as they possibly can, and they're trying to convince her to pose for these pictures, and like, what support does she have? And of course, you know, the media, they're still fascinated by sex today, aren't they? But they're particularly fascinated by this one. So the more lurid details you could get, the better. And Christine Keeler can't defend herself against any of that. So she gets absolutely... I mean, it was a media sensation. It was.
So Christine Keeler has a brief custodial sentence. Stephen Ward commits suicide whilst waiting for the summing up in the jury that's hearing his perjury charges. He takes sleeping tablets. And then you see these ripples, Kate, go on and on and on. Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister, resigns. He cites ill health, but you very much get the feeling that the Profumo affair has been the hand in the small of his back, just pushing him towards the end of his career.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is John Profumo, before it was all blown to hell, it actually stood up in the House of Commons and categorically denied it. This was back in the time when if you told a lie in the House of Commons, that was a resigning.
All those days.
Do you remember those days? Once upon a time, that was like a really big deal. And then it kind of gets to the point where he can't deny it anymore. And he's trying to wait for the scandal to die down in Italy with his wife. And it's just, it's not going to happen. So he has to come back and he basically apologizes, admits that he told a lie and resigns. But that has huge implications for the rest of the government, because now like people came out in support of him. People defended him. And now they all look like they're a lying bunch of so-and-sos who have connections to the Russian spies. And none of this looks good, because Christine Keeley has been painted as this, they kept using the word call girl and prostitute in the press. And so it's all sleaze, isn't it? It's all, and it sticks. So yeah, it weakened the government significantly.
Did they ever prove that secrets had been swapped?
No. No, in fact, there was an inquiry, as there usually is in these things, and it exonerated Profumo completely. You know, one of those internal inquiries that's like, well, we will investigate our own and see if anything bad happened. No, it didn't. So, the other thing is that, of course, the case files on this are still sealed. I don't think they're going to get unsealed until it's like 2046 or something completely mad. And descendants of Stephen Ward are still trying to have his conviction overturned, because it was clearly a show trial, and they just wanted somebody to get for this, somebody to face the music, and sort of trying to convict him of pimping out these young girls was as close as they got.
And just to be clear, what was it that Christine Keeler was actually charged with?
She'd been involved in a few court cases. One was this guy, he went by the name of Lucky. He'd assaulted her and attacked her. And she had sworn in court that he had punched her. And then evidence came to light later on that wasn't quite true. So she was done for perjury. But again, there's a feeling that she was just made an example of. Because if you can convict her for perjury, if you can convict her, say, she's someone who lied in court, then none of her story looks true, does it? Now she just looks like an even worse person than she did before, because the authorities have found her to be a liar.
The aftermath, Katie, for all these characters is telling as well, isn't it? So Christine Keeler, once she comes out of prison in 1964, she has a couple of brief marriages. In the 70s, she is penniless and she continues to sell her stories as a way of desperately trying to make some money. There's a line when she says, "I wasn't living, I was surviving." In the meantime, Profumo has gone to work at Toynley Hall, which is a charity for deprived people in the East End of London. And his rehabilitation is so complete that he gets given the CBE in 1975. Margaret Thatcher refers to him as a national hero. And that's so telling, isn't it? Not only the different paths the two lives took, but the reaction to them.
Gets me so cross. And you can go on YouTube, actually, and you can see interviews with Christine Keeler today. And she's being interviewed, I think she's been interviewed with John Hurt around the time that film came out, so it'd be the 80s. And the tone of the interviewer is very, and they actually say, haven't the Profumo family been through enough? What about their reputation and all this stuff? And it's just, and it makes me so cross, because what happened here is a very, very wealthy, very powerful man cheated on his wife with a teenager who was produced for him at some aristocrat's pile and then thought he could get away with it. And then she is the baddie. For God's sake, she was 19 years old from absolute poverty, and although she always spoke very well of Stephen Ward, there's something manipulative going on there. There's a sort of a certain grooming process, and she is, even if it's not cut and dried exchange sex for money, he is using these girls for leverage, for political leverage, and grooming them to do things. And she's the one that is still, by the 80s, being dragged through the press. He's still this national hero. No, he's not. He cheated on his wife with a child. He's a scumbag.
Seems like the Profumo affair was a morality tale for its time, or maybe of our time. Can you talk about that whole framing of wanton woman tripping up a respectable man as if she's the one with power.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it was framed, was this teenage temptress. You know, I mean, the clue is in the name. Teenage temp, my God. Anyway, it was all framed as like any man that comes into her orbit is so bewitched and besotted that he will eventually have this downfall, proper femme fatale. The morality was all hers to account for. Not John Profumo. All right, he lost his job, but let's face it, he was always going to be okay. He's from vast amounts of money. He was honoured in this, that, and the other. I mean, she never got to live this down. She never got to get out of the shadow of this thing. Her whole life was coloured by it, that she was Christine Keeler.
And even the famous photographs of her sitting mm-hmm. on that backwards chair, that was an attempt for her to try and kind of say, okay, if I'm known for this scandal, I guess I'm going to try and make a little bit of a living from it, because she was trying to promote a film that was never released. I think it was a documentary. But tell us what you know about that actual photo session, because you indicated before that she was quite reluctant.
Yeah, yeah, she was. Apparently, she didn't want to be naked in that picture. She'd signed the contract before she realized, like, had any kind of nudity or modesty clauses put into it, because she's 19 and she doesn't really know what she's doing. And so the compromise was that she kept her pants on and sort of sat on this chair that was backwards so you can't see anything. But she was surrounded by a lot of people that also wanted to exploit her notoriety and were making a lot of money from her as well. And I guess that she did think, well, the press are writing a lot of stuff about me. I may as well try and get a hold of this narrative, and I may as well try and make some money for myself. But she didn't. She was always the least powerful person in all of this.
Kate, what did it do for British society? How did it change British society? Did it make people less deferential towards the establishment? Are we looking at one of the key reasons why the 60s became the way the 60s did in Britain?
I think it probably put a big hole in the respect for the aristocracy, but it didn't sink it. It didn't. What it did do was it got people talking about sex very publicly. I mean, the conversation has been rumbling for a while, but that's kind of what the 60s is known for, isn't it? And then we've got the, you know, the Lady Chatterley censorship trial. Again, people are talking about sex. And the Profumo trial is it like MPs at the time, you know, anyone who's of an older generation will like wistfully talk about MPs in their day and about how it was all respect and blah, blah, blah. But it put a real dent in that, is that people saw, not for the first time, but certainly for a while, that their MPs were getting their ends away in Soho, and it was all rather sordid and tawdry. It made people talk about sex in a very public way. It made people talk about sex for fun in a very public way. And it made people realise that the British aristocracy and the British Parliament would certainly not above reproach.
I love your perspective. As a sex historian, Kate, you're able to look at that and see that it's actually part of the trajectory of people maybe becoming a little more sex positive and sort of less freaked out about it. I know it wasn't a great look for the government, but do you see it as almost kind of a positive thing that people were talking more openly about sex?
I mean, I suppose what we could look at it now is the kind of, it's the genesis of a conversation that led to positive things. It wasn't positive at the time. But I think that if you think about it now, if this scandal broke today, and if it was found out that, I don't even know who our Secretary for War is, but pick one of them, if it came out that they'd been having sex with a 19-year-old at some aristocratic pile. Just imagine that shocker for a second there, that somebody very wealthy and influential had been having sex with teenage girls. I don't think that that would be reported in the same way that it was in 1961. I think that we would be much, much quicker to point out that's a really shit thing to do. That is a really nasty, manipulative thing to do. And that distance between those two things is a very positive thing. So I think at the time, it'd be hard pushed to say that that was a positive conversation, but the fact that it made people talk about sex ultimately led to positive conversations. But I think that the whole affair really needs relooking at.
Were there other scandals that you're aware of that were happening in the 60s to do with sex in the UK?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was... So the Lady Chatterley, that was about trying to decide whether or not this book was indecent or artistic. And again, had everybody talking about whether sex is indecent or artistic. And then everyone could buy the book. So everyone just went nuts and bought the book. But then you've also got maybe not even the things that came to court, but things like the Beatles, you know, Elvis with his pelvis, and like people having to negotiate that for the first time of like, that's quite scandalous. Is that indecent? Is that okay? Then we've got the pill that turns up, which causes another moral tidal wave, I think, of people thinking like, what is this? Now we have to talk about this. You know, the conversation around sex changes significantly in the 60s.
Katie, we will of course be visiting the topic of birth control in 2 episodes' time, because Billy is such a genius that he lines these things up perfectly for us.
I've just unlocked my chastity belt in anticipation of that episode.
Kate Lister, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been wonderful. It has been scurrilous, but it has also been intensely thought-provoking. Thank you very much.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Tom, I absolutely loved hearing Kate talk about this. It really brought to light the hypocrisy. And also, I hadn't put it into that Me Too context, but obviously, she's absolutely right. If that stuff went down today, when that stuff goes down today, it is not treated in the same way. People are much more enlightened about the power dynamics, aren't they?
They are. I think what's striking for me, Katie, reading about it and hearing Kate tell us all about it, is how quickly the establishment covered up. You know, even as the ripples are spreading out, the establishment is trying to make sure there are no further ripples. Even the way that the scandal is referred to. So the official report was authored by Lord Denning, and it comes out in September 1963. It pretty much blames Stephen Ward. It then blames Christine Keeler, and it refers to John Profumo's involvement as, quote, an indiscretion.
Yeah, it's just an oopsie. It's just an
nothing
oopsie.
Nothing to see here. Let's move along.
It's like my old dad said to me once when I showed up a few minutes after my curfew from a date. I think I was about 14 or 15. I was imploring my father to not be mad at my little boyfriend. And, you know, it was my fault. I made the mistake. And he said, I know it's your fault because Eve tempted Adam. Oh. Spoken like a Catholic dad. Women are the ones wielding that apple, and they're the ones leading men, poor, innocent, naive men who don't know any better, down the path of doom and destruction.
Casey, I'm just glad you grew up in a relatively landlocked part of the United States so there could be no gondolas involved.
Oh, I just wanted to pass along a fun fact. So Lewis Morley, the photographer who photographed Christine Keeler in that designer knockoff chair. Later also photographed the playwright Joe Orton in the chair and the TV host, comedian, and then interviewer David Frost.
Oh.
And most interestingly, perhaps, Barry Humphries, who's known for his alter ego, Dame Edna. So that chair has seen a few different gussets.
If chairs could talk, Katie, if chairs could only talk.
So if you want another podcast to listen to, make sure you check out Kate's podcast, Betwixt the Sheets. Or if you want another one of our episodes, well, we'd recommend that you check out one of our favorite episodes, which is British Beatlemania with Mark Lewison. We loved it so much. We kept yapping to the guy, and we made it into a two-parter, and it'll help paint a picture of what was going on in the world around the time of the Profumo affair.
If you would like to get in touch with maybe a story about the things you've been hearing or a guest idea for a future episode, you can contact us on email. We are at fire@crowdnetwork.co.uk. We are also, of course, on social media. We are at Spread That Fire on Instagram and Twitter. And do not forget, dear listeners, to check out our merchandise collection at spreadthatfire.com.
According to Billy's syllabus, the next topic will be JFK blown away.
That is a big one, Katie. There are plenty of conspiracies for you and I to investigate before then. We'll see you next time.
Crowd Network.
A place where you belong.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello everyone, my name is Tom Kearns and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each 3-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II, and people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.